This list shrank from yesterday?
There were only three.
Are we ready for ignition and liftoff?
We are. Open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning. Today is Tuesday, April 25th. We've got three Senate bills that have come over for us to have a look at, and then an informational hearing about Oregon invasive species. With that, we've got one of our favorite senators here, so he's got two bills. So I'm going to open public hearings on Senate Bill 372A and 373A and ask Senator Hansel to come up and tell us about these two.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you regarding Senate Bill 372A, known as the Wildlife Salvage Bill. It comes to you having received a unanimous vote off the Senate floor and is endorsed by the Sportsman Caucus. I thought it might be helpful to give you some background on how this bill came to be. Sometimes while I drive in eastern Oregon, I see dead deer lying on the side of the road having been killed by a motor vehicle. These animals wait for either ODOT crews, county road crews, or Mother Nature to dispose of the carcass. I found myself asking, is there some way we might be able to salvage these animals? I found an article written in the October 2015 State Legislature's NCSL magazine, which was entitled, Faster Permits for Free-Range Deer. It stated that Wisconsin motorists can now contact the Department of Natural Resources and have a permit sent via email to them in order to salvage the meat of the animal they just hit. My office began compiling data on what other states do in regard to wildlife salvage. It was interesting to find out 20 states across the nation allow for salvage of animals hit by motor vehicles. Most do so through permits issued by law enforcement or fish and wildlife officials. Some of these states include Vermont, New York, Florida, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, West Virginia, Colorado, and most recently, Washington State. In fact, Montana has taken their salvage program to the next level, and they are in the process of creating an app for your phone. When you hit an animal, you can submit the necessary information through the app to gain the salvage permit. In many states, this permit is free of charge. In addition to looking at what other states do, we contacted ODOT to see if they had records for how many animals were hit in the state. We found out animals reported to ODOT in 2015, 6,061 deer and elk were killed by vehicles on Oregon roadways. Of these, 1,539, or about 25%, happened in ODOT Region 5, which is mostly in eastern Oregon. Well, in fact, all in eastern Oregon. Currently, ODOT disposes of animal carcasses in a variety of methods, through natural disposal, dragging it away from the public view, incineration if the carcass is from Clackamas County, composting it if it occurs near the city of Heppner, in some rare circumstances and rare conditions, burial, and sometimes landfills, although many landfills do not accept animal carcasses. Senate Bill 372A attempts to address the carcasses on the road right away. Senate Bill 372A allows for a person at no liability for the state to salvage the meat if they so desire. We have been working with ODFW's Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, throughout the entirety of this bill, and through conversations with her, left the official rulemaking to the department and the commission. The bill, per ODFW's wishes, does state that the meat is intended for human consumption only. This bill also allows for the salvage of meat hit by a car but dispatched through our humane euthanasia statute. In other words, if an animal is injured but still alive after the collision, you can dispatch it and still salvage the meat. I would say on this particular issue, we probably still have some disagreement with wildlife officials. It was the feeling of the Senate committee, and it passed unanimously off the floor, and of those of us as we worked it, that to hit an animal and let it suffer and was not right. To hit an animal and dispatch it and then not be able to salvage the meat was not right. You either let it die and suffer, and then you could take it. There was some concern about poaching. We've been assured by members of the Wildlife Caucus, Sportsman Caucus, that that issue doesn't override the humane treatment of the animal. And we think we can, we've got it where it be, but Senator Dembrough agreed that we absolutely, the humane thing to do was dispatch it, and we shouldn't penalize the person because they wouldn't be able to salvage it. Again, in summary, it passed out of the Senate Environment and Natural Resource Committee in a 5-0 vote. Unanimously passed off the floor of the Senate. It's endorsed by the Sportsman Caucus. We worked with ODF&W from the beginning of the concept. We amended to address most of the concerns from ODF&W and the Oregon State Police. And it gives us the opportunity to join other states who have successfully implemented a similar program. We aren't reinventing the wheel. And lastly, with the first name Bill that I have, I hope I will not become known as Roadkill Bill as a result of this bill. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, no promises that you may not have earned that moniker, but any questions on this one? We do have a couple folks to come up after you from ODF&W and OSP. Why don't you tell us about your other bill?
Okay. I was going to suggest, you know, I believe my good colleague Greg Barreto's on this bill as well.
And I think you're
maybe
right.
In the House, it could be he could be referred to as Roadkill Greg.
Yeah, we could try that.
Just doesn't have the same ring.
Doesn't. I'm afraid it does.
How do you think he goes elk on?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29. Thank you for the opportunity, again, to speak with you regarding 373A, which is known as Urban Deer Population Bill. In April of 2016, just a year ago, we were contacted by the mayor of Joseph, Mr. Dennis Sands, regarding the deer within their city. Mayor Sands stated there were 150 deer in a nearly square-mile limit city. He stated he contacted Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife about the issue. They agreed Joseph had a problem, but due to budget and manpower, there was not much they could do. To trap and relocate had not been very successful, and Mayor Sands was asking for help. We met with Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director, and Ron Anglin, former wildlife manager, before he retired regarding the issue in Joseph. They stated many cities are having deer population problems, Joseph, John Day, Union, Ashland, parts of Portland, to name a few. This was confirmed when we reached out to League of Oregon Cities. My office began working to craft a bill that would give local control to cities and tools to deal with the situation if they so chose. We met with Oregon Food Bank to see if there was a way that they could be involved in the bill, and there was. By working with the Oregon Food Bank, we discovered they could and desired to use the meat in their local pantries. Senate Bill 373A creates a pilot program for cities, if they decide to do so, to humanely euthanize and remove problem deer within the city. This is an attempt to bring the population levels into a more manageable number. Once the animals have been removed, the meat will be donated to local food banks. It should be emphasized this is local control at the city's cost. If the city decides they do not want to pursue this option, they don't have to. The cost for the removal of deer falls 100% on the city. What does the bill do? This bill does not allow hunters to march through neighborhoods shooting deer. It does not allow for cities to remove deer at any time. ODF&W must agree to it. It does not require a city to participate. It is not a mandate. We left the specific program up to the department to create through rulemaking. However, we did list a few specifics. The first thing a city must do is pass an ordinance or resolution stating they have a deer population problem. Only after the city has taken the first step can the program move forward. Next, it is the intent of the bill to have the agency, such as the State Animal Damage Control, do the humane euthanasia. Wildlife services and agents could provide these removal services. Under Senate Bill 373A, cities could be able to keep the would be able to keep the hides and antlers to offset city costs. And finally, before this program can even be implemented, if a city qualifies, they must implement wildlife feeding ordinances. This bill has a sunset of 2027, allowing 7 years for the program to be operational, giving 2017 and 18 for the department to create the rules for this program. Again, the bill attempts to solve a need in many cities from across the state. It forbids the feeding of wildlife and removes the problem deer to bring the population numbers into a more sustainable number. Joseph already has deer dying in people's front yards because there's not enough food for all 150 during the winter. I'm sure other cities probably have the same situation. The League of Oregon Cities testified in favor of this bill on the Senate side. Thank you again, Chair Clem, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing this bill. And deer inside city limits in parts of the state is a really, really big issue. So you talked about euthanizing the animal. What do you really mean? Because you don't walk up to a deer and give it a shot. You want to be careful trapping it. You can't shoot a firearm in the city limits. So do you want to talk a little bit about what that really means? Or do you want the department to talk about that?
Actually, Chair Clem, Representative Springer, under the current law, certain officials do have the ability to discharge firearms within the city limit, and they can take it. That came out of the hearing in the because the same question was asked on the House on the Senate side, and they do have the authority to remove them that way. Part of the problem with darting is that the meat then isn't able for human consumption. Mm-hmm. Plus, the deer doesn't immediately. Expire. They couldn't run some distance and expire. So we feel that with wildlife services, the professional folks that they are, that and this is a part of the rulemaking, that we would have the opportunity to dispatch them in that way.
Thank you. Another question?
Follow up.
Thank you.
Representative
Talk to us a little bit about I'm sure the cities have told you about some damage. Talk to us a little bit about that, that this isn't just a case of a lot of deer in town.
Chair Clem, Representative Springer, Vice Chair. One of the city councilmen in Joseph said his dog was gored by a deer and they had to require it was pretty painful, and they had to require veterinary services to help him heal. You have that. You have a real aggressiveness, particularly during the winter months. Gardens, fecal matter, communication. We haven't had it yet, but deer carry Lyme disease. So there's health and human, health issues as well. Where they are aggressive, they can charge. You know, they're just different. It's not a good interface. They belong in the woods. They come in, and particularly if there's multi-generational, the fawns, they grow up. That's all they know. This is their place. So there are a number of issues: the droppings, the traffic hazard, the eating veg. You know, the flowers, the flower beds, the nuisance. And I think it's just a matter of time before somebody, and maybe that's already happened, will in fact be charged or gored by a deer, and we'll have human issues as well.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Good morning. I was really pleased that you had put in there the no feeding aspect of it, because that's one of the issues that I think is really a concern. And my dad used to always say, if you don't want them around, don't feed them. And it's a situation where it doesn't matter if it's raccoons or if it's deer or whatever. And when folks start feeding them on the back porch or whatever, they're going to come. And so thank you for thinking that through and getting through that cycle of really trying to make sure that we keep wild animals in the forest or on the range or wherever they are versus in our urban areas.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I will say this was one of the great inputs that ODF&W suggested that we amend it and put it in, and we were happy to do so. It made good sense.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good bill. Both of them are very good bills. The mistake people make is they start feeding animals because they're cute. Well, that's fine, except the animal doesn't know any difference. And if you recall, we had a lady over on the coast that had 17 bears she was feeding. Well, the lady went on vacation, but unfortunately the bears didn't. And they ripped her house apart, and they ripped the neighbor's house apart. And so we had to pass a law to prohibit that. But you cannot do justice by feeding any wild animal. And when I say that, not only do you cause a problem, but more importantly, that animal gets to where it depends upon that. And once that supply is cut off, then the animal's in trouble. So I would hope that we would go ahead and proceed with these bills.
I remember the photos of crazy bear lady kissing the bears.
Kissing a bear, yeah.
Oh, I'd forgotten all about that. That was the craziest thing I've ever seen. She'd get right in and kiss them.
Yeah, she was kissing one of them.
It sounds like strange. I walked in at just the right time.
Yeah, you just walked into the right moment. Representative Bretto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just like to thank you, Mr. Roadkill Bill, for asking me to co-sponsor this with you. And, this is not just up in Joseph. I mean, I had the same phone calls from Union and also from Elgin. And it is a problem especially over there during the winter when the snow comes down. And also, I think some of the deer up at Wallowa Lake that make their way down into Joseph, I think you could just walk up to them and inoculate them. So.
You can try that.
I was going to ask, while we use the term pilot program, is it limited to a certain number, or is it just based on how many cities apply and what rulemaking ends up?
Chair Clem, we pretty much, I don't know that we have a specific number, but we kind of made it a pilot so gave ODF&W a time to work with cities that wanted to work together. Okay. We're assuming that some will want to move forward. They're not required to, they're not obligated to, but get the procedures underway and the particulars. But it definitely requires the local governing authority to say we want to do something.
Yeah.
If they don't want to do anything, then the wildlife will continue to be there.
I do recall somewhere more central, feel like it was Maupin or Shamico or somewhere, I got all these photos sent to me about 5 years ago from a lady who felt pinned in her own home because the deers were out in the yard. And I mean, she showed photos, and they were all over her yard, and she didn't feel safe to even go outside. So I knew that there were a few towns that were sort of overrun. So I don't know that a limit is actually necessary if it's problematic in multiple towns, and that's fine. Okay. Vice Chair Springer.
I was trying to refrain. Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I won't. Last September, when we moved our son into a house right in LeGrand, two blocks off Adams Street, the main street, we heard some commotion in September, middle of the day. We hear deer are not out in the middle of the day on a sunny day. And middle of the day, we hear this commotion, and there's three bucks just outside his cyclone fence with our dogs in the yard barking at them. And we're talking big bucks just hanging out in the middle of the street, cars waiting, just like I waited for the duck on Court Street today to cross. And there's just not a lot of fear. And that's not the first time we've seen bucks in LeGrand in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm. Boy, a couple more weeks in Eastern Oregon, they'd be in trouble. Well, the bow hunters maybe earlier. But.
My son refrained.
Yeah. Yeah.
Representing Chair Clem, too, if I may. Part of the thing that we wanted to craft in this bill is that we just don't remove them and then do nothing manage-wise down. And this gets to what Representative McLean said. We want to manage it, you know, and bring it down to an acceptable level, let ODFW work on that, but do the anti-feeding to make it a long-term solution rather than just a momentary one. And that's part of it. If they're not willing to pass an anti-feeding and hopefully enforce it, then the program doesn't move forward for them.
Senator, while we've still got you here, and we've got some members who missed this part of your testimony, do you want to comment on the issue that I think we'll hear about from state police and ODFW regarding on the other bill, the roadkill, we'll call it, the wildlife salvage permits?
There you go.
If somebody hits them with their car, then can they shoot them to put them out of their misery, or is that too big of a loophole that someone might shoot them and then claim they hit them with their car?
In working with ODFW and the state police on the Senate side, from my opinion, we came to a conclusion, we came to agreement on everything that they wanted in the bill, suggestions, and except on this one. It just, and that was that if an animal is hit by a vehicle on a road right away, that was part of what we tried to bring it down so it's on a road right away. You can't use your vehicle out in the woods just to run something over. That doesn't apply here. But within a road right away, that oftentimes the deer or elk doesn't die immediately. They're injured. They're crippled. They can't move. And we already have humane euthanasia laws on the books that you are allowed to dispatch that animal, regardless of where an injury might occur. They may break a leg running away or whatever. You can put them out of their misery. That's what hunters do. That's the humane thing to do. Where the difference came in is that if you hit the animal and you dispatched it alongside the road, you couldn't salvage it then. So at least that's what they wanted, because they were afraid, and some states, I think Washington may already have that. And I talked with Chair Dembro of the committee, and we just didn't feel that was the humane thing. You were left with two options. You could either wait till the animal died, which was not, to me, the right thing to do, or you could put it out of the misery. If you put it out of the misery, then you weren't allowed to salvage it. Mm-hmm. And you're right back to where we've always been. We're just going to rot alongside the road, or ODOT, or somebody's got to get rid of it. So I also spoke with folks from the Sportsman Caucus on this issue, and some of the former wildlife enforcement issues. They said if somebody's doing that, if they're using that as a means of poaching, he said the hunter community, the rural communities, they don't agree with that. And he said the vast majority of the folks that we were able to cite for poaching came as a result of the community anonymously or otherwise turning them in. So if somebody's out there shooting and dragging deer or elk alongside the road and running over them, it's not going to, first of all, it doesn't happen. They didn't think it happened that much. I don't either, if at all, or this wouldn't motivate that. But they felt the community would rise up. We're trying to do something positive that other states have done to salvage that meat and make a little better and otherwise pretty tragic situation. Vehicles are destroyed. People are hospitalized for these type of collisions. If you want it, you're able to salvage the meat. So we built in to the bill that you could use the already existing humane euthanasia laws to dispatch, put the animal out of the misery if you hit it with your vehicle on the road, or it could be put out, and you could still salvage it. Otherwise, you incentivize people not putting them out of the misery, waiting for them to die naturally so they could have the meat. I don't think that's right. That's so, why we put it in.
So to clarify, the bill isn't intended to give a new right other than the current law on humane euthanization. It's just meant to somehow reference or incorporate the current humane euthanization law?
Yeah. You can humanely euthanize wildlife that are injured now.
Yeah.
I don't think you can, having done that, you can salvage that meat. You can't take it home. You can't use it, the wild.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did in this bill for roadkill or vehicle damage on road right-of-ways, it has to be, it's a collision. You can take a picture of the car or whatever, but it has to be the collision. If that animal is still living, but it's going to die, can't run, can't, whatever, you're able to apply the humane euthanasia, and the exception is, to that law, you can salvage the meat in this instance of a collision, as you would be able to if the animal died on the collision.
Yeah, right. I understand. Okay. Any further questions right at the moment? Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
So let's stay with 372 for the moment, and we've got Shannon, Doug, and Jeff. Why don't you all come up together if you can.
Good morning, Chair Klim, members of the committee. For the record, Shannon Hearn, Deputy Director at Department of Fish and Wildlife. We want to first say that we appreciate Senator Hansel, and he is trying to help us address two very difficult issues around wildlife management. So very much appreciate that. We have come a long way on this bill, 372. Appreciate the opportunity to comment on it today. We are neutral on the bill, but again, we very much appreciate his work on this and the partnership that we've had. He is right, and our concern remains around the poaching loophole. But before we get into that, really we are looking at modeling after Washington's program. You heard Senator Hansel give the numbers of road struck deer and elk that we have in Oregon. It's very similar in Washington. With that, they, in the year that they've had this program, they've had 1,100 permits used. We would expect to see about the same. We very much appreciate that the state of Oregon is now exempt from certifying that meat. We go through the ODA training to really look at whether that meat is usable after an incident with a vehicle. And most of the time we see it's not. We typically only certify if it's been head struck. The department doesn't have the personnel to go out and do that for these folks, especially if you get to 1,100. So, Dr. Cottom's here. He's going to talk a little bit about rules that are there, but I do want to address the Humane Statute 49-016. Currently, as that is written, when you euthanize that animal, you need to immediately report it, and then you turn it over to the appropriate officials. Because we don't have a wildlife salvage program, there has not been a way to give it back to the citizen. If it's usable meat, it does go to a food bank or a tribe. Troopers, tribal staff, our staff are usually the ones preparing that meat to get it there. If this law passes, we would have the ability for an officer to decide to give it to the citizen who euthanized it and report it. It's just we don't have that process here now. So with that, I'll let Dr. Cottom discuss what this would look like in rules.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Cottom, Wildlife Division Administrator. There are several administrative rules that we would consider. One of the ones that we will have to do is prohibit the salvage of deer in the three lower Columbia counties, that's Clatsop, Columbia, and Multnomah County, because we have federally listed white-tailed deer that reside in those counties, federal law would not allow those deer to be salvaged. And for the most part, most people cannot tell the difference between a black-tailed deer and a white-tailed deer. Our neighboring state of Washington has prohibited the salvage of deer in their lower Columbia River counties as well. We'd also consider requiring folks to remove the deer or elk from the road right-of-way to salvage it for a variety of reasons, one including safety, having people stand alongside the road and or gutting out an animal. But it also would reduce the likelihood of other animals like scavengers getting hit by cars if the gut piles and things are left alongside the road. We would also have a rule that would only allow the salvage of deer along public roadways and not private roadways. There are many, many back road private roadways. And we would, like Shannon was mentioning, we would, if we had to do it in rural, make sure that if a law enforcement officer dispatched a deer that was injured, that they could then offer it to the motor vehicle driver who actually struck the deer.
Absolutely. Good morning. For the record, my name is Jeff Samuels, and I'm the captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division. The state police is neutral on this bill, and I do support the senator and his work on this bill. It is a bill that has merit, and as mentioned previously, Washington has a similar program, and they require that within 24 hours, a motorist that kills a deer or elk with their vehicle can then get a permit to lawfully salvage that deer and keep it. The poaching loophole has been referenced today, and I just wanted to provide just a couple scenarios for you to consider about this bill, particularly the part about dispatching an animal after you struck it with a motor vehicle and then it's crippled or helpless. It does create a loophole. And so one of the scenarios I wanted to discuss was that a poacher unlawfully shoots a doe deer out of season and then begins to transport the deer back to his residence in his pickup. Well, on the way home, the poacher is stopped by a trooper for no brake lights, and the trooper observes the deer in the back of the pickup and starts talking to that person about it. And the poacher claims that he's salvaging the doe, had a motor vehicle collision, and plans to get the permit within 24 hours. And so if you look at that same scenario today, the fact that the poacher has the doe in possession when it's closed season is prima facie evidence that the doe was killed unlawfully under ORS 496-690, which is possession of wildlife, as evidence of illegal taking, and the trooper would seize the doe deer and issue a citation for the unlawful take or possession of that deer. So it does create this potential for someone to unlawfully take deer. Maybe not even, it wouldn't be even in a motor vehicle collision, but then claim that it was a motor vehicle collision to hide or keep that deer. So I do want to bring that up. I understand and appreciate the intent of Senate Bill 372, and I have discussed with Washington Enforcement about their model up there, and they say it is workable. And again, they don't allow the salvage of deer or elk that are helpless, that are crippled from the motor vehicle collision and then are shot afterwards for the same reason.
Vice Chair McLean.
Sir, this is what I was wondering is, you know, how often do you think that was going to happen? My mom had a deer run out in front of the road on her way to the coast with my nephews in the back. And to me, as I think about 6,000, you know, deer in that scenario, and I think about who they run out in front of. There's no way she could have dispatched that deer. There was no way that she could have, you know, considered, you know, doing anything with that deer unless a state police officer had come along and helped with that. She certainly could have cooked the venison. She knew how to do that quite well. But I mean, her situation, little kids in the back seat, blah blah blah. But my point is how many times do you think that the scenarios that you're talking about, I mean, you're going to know how many type of poachers are going to go to that much work to make it look like an accident on a public roadway. So how often do you think that's going to happen?
Sure. So Chair Clem and Vice Chair McLean, I'm not sure how many times that would happen. I can tell you that our troopers detect about 500 deer a year unlawfully taken and possessed, and roughly about 200 or so elk. And that's just what we detect, you know, and from the help of the citizens. But I'm not sure exactly, but it just creates that potential for a loophole, that particular issue.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I've got a couple questions. So, and thanks for coming to my office and talking about this. I want to try to get us to a good place here because I think that this is an important bill. So the comment was made as far as rulemaking that there would be a rule prohibiting dressing out the animal on a right-of-way. So that would be the ditch also. And oftentimes, if not the majority of the time, then you have private property. So that seems very prohibitive. What's some of the thinking behind that, and how can we get around that?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, this again is modeled after Washington. Washington Department of Transportation had a real concern about people skinning out animals along the roadway and being struck. So the intention, knowing that most of these are deer struck, it's a smaller percentage of elk, they can be easily loaded and transported to another location. Hopefully folks aren't transporting well out of the bar ditch to go retrieve an animal, because that then gets into another issue. But most of the time, when you observe or struck a deer, most of the ones that they will be salvaging will be fairly easily retrievable within the right-of-way, I think.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
And I just want to point out that one of the concerns you mentioned is the gut pile in the ditch and vultures coming and them getting hit. The gut pile is no worse than the deer that's laying there now.
There you go.
There's a deer there now. Another question, Mr. Chair.
Fair follow-up.
So I'm also concerned about the person who poaches the deer and then says, I hit it with my car. And so I'm thinking about what an officer goes through in their mind when they come across somebody who has done that. You have a deer without a tag, or it's not season, or whatever, in your truck. How'd that happen? Well, I hit it. Where'd you hit it? What part of the vehicle? Show me the vehicle. Well, there's no damage on my vehicle because I have a grill guard or whatever. But typically, unfortunately, I have a lot of experience hitting deer. I have a lot of experience investigating hit deer, and I have a lot of experience shooting them when they're in the ditch. But the reality is there's almost always some hair on the car. We've had hair on our car, and the deer ran off and was absolutely fine. There's usually something on the car, and there's usually hair, at the very least, missing on some part of the deer. Not always. Now, granted, that creates more work in the investigation, and granted, that may create a more challenging scenario to get a conviction of poaching versus this, but isn't there some latitude there in the investigation to determine what's going on?
So Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, you are correct. It would be an investigation that we would do and look at all those factors. Mm-hmm. So relative to latitude, I mean, that's officers are going to do an investigation, like you mentioned, in those situations where we have time, where we are able to do that and have that evidence in front of us.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would assume that an officer that stopped someone and had a suspicion of a poacher would be looking at, one, is the angle of the bullet that dispatched it, and two, would be looking at whether the deer had or elk had broken limbs. I mean, that's the first thing I'd look at. Then I'd also be looking, just like Representative Springer said, looking at the vehicle, because you hit something, there's going to be hair someplace. Has to be. And especially if you've hit it hard enough that you hurt it so bad that it can't get up, And especially if they hit an elk, because you're going to probably have to be towed away. Mm-hmm. So I'm there's a loophole there, but boy, that's quite a loophole. And who would go out and shoot a deer and then run over it with their vehicle? They're not going to do that. They're going to be out poaching. They're going to poach anyway. It doesn't matter. So I think that we're probably worried about something that probably, if it happens at all, I'd be surprised.
Representative Wett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the risk of getting in the weeds, I wanted to follow up on Representative Springer's line of questioning on gut piles. And I was just wondering if we had any data on the impacts of ethyl glycol or radiator fluid on the recovery of the California condor.
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, I think we have to look into that one and get back to you.
We'll need a full comprehensive study by tomorrow. Thank you. Representative Brock Smith.
Boy, you caught us looking on that one.
I tell you, Senator, you bring some interesting conversations to our committee. And in the spirit of those interesting conversations, I'm going to tell just a quick story. So growing up on the Elk River in southwest Oregon, there was a lot of deer over the days. And unfortunately, in my time of growing up, there was 7 that were struck just by me. Unfortunately, that was the case because you have a lot of gorse. Thank you, Representative McCann. And they just pop right out on the road, and there's a lot of twists and turns. In fact, one time it was raining so bad near Marsh Ranch, and there's some S-turns that I was in my 56 Ford Fairlane and hit 3 at one time as they were crossing the road. They were never found on the side of the road. But to go to the hare comment, which reminded me of the story from Representative Springer, 20-plus years later, there's still a tuft of hair underneath the stainless on the passenger's driver's side door this many years later. So, Senator, appreciate the bill. It's a good bill, and it sounds like we've commented it to death, no pun intended, here today.
Okay. Any further questions about...
So I want to say I don't know what we're doing with this bill today. If we're going to move
today.
It. Okay. I think that you bring a valid concern, and I've thought about this a lot in the last couple days about how this could play out, and I think the possibility exists for certain that somebody's going to abuse this law. The reality is, I think, and I don't know, but I think the potential of that and the numbers of that compared to at least sometimes salvaging, and let's remember, a lot of hit deer are, you don't want to salvage. You just don't. But some you do, and I think that my hope would be if you are considering that, you're smart enough to figure out if that's a good idea or not, or you take it to your local slaughterhouse like we do. But I would want to see numbers, and certainly if this bill moves forward, I would want to see numbers, and I would want the department, both departments, very carefully to track that information, and if all of a sudden we skyrocket on the amount of deer, we're going to track that. I would want to watch this. Definitely want to watch this and see if we have a spike. We may, if this passes, need to revisit it. But I got to tell you, I guarantee you right now, and all I do is drive from this Capitol to my house and from my house to this Capitol right now. It's all I do. I don't hit any of my other roads, just like probably everybody up here. I can guarantee you I can go find a dead deer along the road within 10 miles of my house within a half hour. They're just always there.
Me too.
And it's such a waste. And we got vultures eating them now. And cats and dogs messing with them. So I want to figure out a way to move this bill. I really do.
Representative Escobar.
Yes, you mentioned about the whitetail in 3 counties. What significance is that? Because I don't believe they prohibit that during a hunting season. I think you can shoot a whitetail, can you not?
No, they're endangered.
Chair Clem, Representative Escobar. No, you can't kill a
federally listed white-tailed deer in those counties.
Man, that'd be, how would you know?
Careful what you're shooting.
Don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions on these?
Better make sure.
Okay. Thank you. I think we've asked ourselves out for the moment. And then Scott, can you join us on the urban deer population control program? Switching back from roadkill to urban deer.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 373. This bill comes to us from most of the cities we've talked to are in east of the mountains, but we do know that this is an issue throughout the state. In point of fact, I live 3 miles from Washington Square, and I've had a herd of 8 in my front yard, although I don't think we have any intention of using this particular method to resolve that issue. What I would expect to happen first before cities even began conversations with ODFW, if they have not done so already, is that they would adopt anti-feeding ordinances and enforce those as the first step. And then there are plenty of safeguards within this bill. The city would apply to ODFW. There'd be a conversation there. There'd be an ordinance, which is a very public process in which everyone will have their say. And then we would enact and ensure that this is done in a way that is most humane and protects the public. It is a serious public safety concerns in parts of the state. I do remember traveling in eastern Oregon in John Day area of Prairie City right after a motorcyclist was hit at or near the city boundary, and it was very concerning to all parties involved, including the deer. We do believe that this is a necessary tool to protect the public health and safety of our city residents and ensure healthy deer populations.
Okay. Any questions for Scott?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 373 and 372. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 18A. And ask Lisa Hansen to join us. And anybody else that you've got, there's nobody signed up. So. We don't have paperwork. Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And with me is Stephanie Page. She's the director of our food safety program area. We bring to you a relatively simple bill, I think, but with a long history to visit with you about. It relates to the Food Safety Modernization Act. The act was passed in 2011. FDA has been adopting rules over the past several years related to how food is grown and handled in the U.S. And what it really does is it proposes to take a more proactive approach to food safety. And it looks at a process from farm to fork. What Senate Bill 18 does specifically is provides ODA clear authority to implement this act in Oregon. It provides ODA the ability to adopt rules to carry out the Food Safety Modernization Act, and it provides clear authority to allow us to mirror basically what the federal government is doing, and it aligns us with that. And then it also aligns along with human food, our animal feed laws, which are also part of the Food Safety Modernization Act. And so what we thought we would do, if it's acceptable to the committee, is Stephanie would give you a little bit of background on the Food Safety Modernization Act, just to refresh everybody's memory about how all-encompassing this is. And then we can visit a little more about the specifics of Senate Bill 18A.
All right. Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Stephanie Page with Oregon Department of Agriculture. As Deputy Director Hansen said, the Food Safety Modernization Act, and I'll refer to it as FSMA for short, was passed in Congress in 2011. Many state public health agencies supported the act because it takes a more proactive preventive approach to food safety, in addition to responding to incidents of foodborne illness. We've seen some of the impacts to the agriculture industry of outbreaks associated with a particular product, and so we supported that preventive approach. In addition, the act is estimated to prevent approximately 330,000 illnesses per year, with a savings of $925 million annually in those illness-related costs. The Food and Drug Administration developed several draft rules to implement the act. ODA has been very involved in commenting on those draft rules in collaboration with our produce industries here in the state and with our fellow Western states. FDA, to their credit, came out and toured the Pacific Northwest to get a better understanding of particularly our irrigation systems, understand some of the challenges with the initial drafts that they put out. And so they really did try to listen in the final rules that they adopted in 2015. So this is a list of the final main rules that have been adopted. The first three, as Deputy Director Hansen said, are the areas where ODA will be most involved, but certainly all of these will impact Oregon agriculture and food businesses. And one note on here is that there is a rule dealing specifically with imported food. The goal of that rule is to ensure parity for international farms and food businesses with the requirements that United States producers are expected to follow with these rules. Here's just a list of the programs within ODA that will be the lead or will be involved in implementing those main three rules that I mentioned. We have a feeds program in animal health that will work on commercial feeds, and then our market access and certification programs and food safety programs are collaborating on the produce safety and manufactured foods for human rules. The timeline when these rules will take effect varies by the rule, and in addition, there are staggered compliance dates based on business size. So there is a complicated chart that keeps track of all the deadlines that even those of us who are very involved have to refer to frequently. So there's a complicated schedule out there. One piece of really good news, I think, is not only is there a delayed implementation date for the irrigation and other agricultural water portion of the produce safety rule, but FDA has agreed to take another look at that portion of the rule. We continued to have concerns along with many other states and ag producers about some of the provisions in the final piece of that rule. So I talked about the benefits in terms of saving foodborne illnesses at the beginning. Here are some of the economic impacts that are expected as a result of these rules to Oregon agriculture and food. So I won't rattle off all of those numbers, but as you can see on the slide, the compliance cost, both for farms and for food manufacturers, is expected to be significant. And some businesses may be subject to more than one rule depending on their business structure and what all they have going on their operation. A few more details on the produce safety rule. There are several important exemptions for very small businesses. There's one for farms with less than $25,000 in annual produce sales. So that's one. There's another exemption for farms with less than $500,000 in annual food sales, as long as over 50% of those sales are sold directly to end users, such as consumers or restaurants. The agricultural water provision is, as I mentioned, is the greatest concern area that we had about the final rule, but it includes several other provisions regarding compost or manure used in produce growing, worker health and hygiene, domesticated and wild animal access to growing areas, those kinds of things. And there is a requirement for at least one person at each covered operation to attend training. So that is a quick overview of the produce safety rule. This is a quick slide about the manufactured foods rules, both for food processors and commercial feed producers. There's some updates to basic sanitation requirements that we already work with these firms on. Many of the larger firms will have to go through a hazard identification process and develop plans to control those hazards. Many larger businesses already have these plans in place, but there will be a steep learning curve for especially some of the smaller businesses that are affected. There's a lot of record keeping involved with these new rules. And we've identified in collaboration with the industry a couple of types of businesses that will be affected that we do not currently regulate. One is produce packing houses and the other is mint stills. So that's, again, sectors of the industry that we've had a lot of conversations with and continue to do outreach to.
Let's start with Representative McKeon, though.
Well, this is maybe rather esoteric, but why mint stills and not other oil-producing?
Chair Clem, Representative McKeon, I think we currently license and inspect most other types of oil extraction facilities that are in a food establishment. We have... Historically, we haven't licensed mint stills or worked with them closely because they are considered an on-farm activity. So I think they just hadn't previously been regulated, hadn't realized that that might be something that was needed. And so when the draft rule came out, they wisely reached out to us and asked how the rule would affect them. And it took a lot of back and forth with FDA to fully understand that. But FDA clarified that, yes, mint stills would be subject to the rule.
Follow up?
Follow up.
So is that from fairly to assume then that canola oil or olive oil, those are already regulated in some way that mint stills were not?
Chair Klein, Representative McKeon, that's correct. If someone is extracting oil for food grade purposes, it's very likely that it's already regulated by us. So olive oil extractors, canola oil for food extractors would be regulated by us. Or if they're extracting meal and selling that as commercial feed, it's likely to be registered with us as a commercial feed.
Okay, and likely means it is. Okay, thank you.
She got it.
Okay, sorry, please go ahead.
Sure. So some of the implementation strategies that we believe are needed for this these rules to be successfully implemented are, again, a lot of outreach. I think it's fair to say a lot of farms particularly are still not aware that these rules have been adopted. Training, as I mentioned, there is required training as part of complying with the produce safety rule, so that we've got about 1,900 covered farms in the state that will need to attend training. On-site technical assistance, that's something that we feel is a strength of our staff and our programs, is helping to educate folks into compliance through a voluntary on-site visit. And then capital and operational improvements. That's something that we have not seen federal resources specifically dedicated to, but certainly both food establishments and produce farms may need to make some capital improvements to comply. ODA has received a five-year, $3.5 million grant from the Food and Drug Administration to do outreach, technical assistance, and farm inventory, which is voluntary, over a five-year period. We've just hired one staff person as part of this project and plan to hire a couple more to help with the outreach and other work. We also plan to partner with OSU to provide the classroom training. That's really a strength that we rely on OSU for, is that training capability. There's also a separate pot of funding to support inspection and enforcement work, and we have not yet decided whether we're going to apply for that. We're waiting in part to see how the ag water provisions come out after the review, and just wanted to build our authorities prior to obtaining that those funds. On the preventive controls side, the manufacturer's food side, we already work in our food safety program with most facilities that will be affected by the human manufactured food rule, but we will end up spending more time with each of those firms as the rules take effect, reviewing records that they're required to keep, help reviewing their plans to evaluate and control hazards. And so each inspection we estimate will take about twice as long as it does now. Currently, no federal funding is available for that increased time that we expect to be involved. And then on the animal side, kind of the same situation. We, in both areas, we will likely adopt the new rule by reference, and that's something we do in many of our food safety-related rules. We've adopted the federal requirements. So we may conduct inspections on the animal food side, too, depending on federal resources and whether we can get the support to do that work. So again, these rules will have a tremendous impact on Oregon agriculture and food. We believe they need a lot of assistance with implementation, particularly our produce farms and some of our smaller food and feed firms. We're still evaluating our role when it comes to conducting inspections and what that will look like depending on federal resources. The bill that we're presenting to you today provides ODA with the basic authority to participate.
And Vice Chair McClain?
The only question that I had on somewhere in the beginning when you were talking about criteria or goals of mm-hmm. the program for mm-hmm. success was that you had made sure that any international provider was also going to have to compete under these same rules mm-hmm. for, you know, any exchange of crops or mm-hmm. food stuff. Is that correct?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, that's correct. That is something that the FDA is charged with doing. And the way that rule is implemented is that importers need to maintain the documentation showing that they have verified that their suppliers are meeting the rules or their equivalent in their exporting countries.
Okay. If I might add just a little bit to this, I think the department has taken a go-slow approach mm-hmm. to implementing the Food Safety Modernization Act. There's still a lot of unknowns around it. It's clear that the program is the first major overhaul to the food safety system in the U.S. in many, many years. And it's a big change in terms of its impact on farmers and producers specifically. And so there's still some controversy, I think, in the industry in terms of should ODA do the inspections or should it be done by FDA. I think generally there's been pretty strong consensus. They want us involved in the education and outreach in preparing them for the act and the full implementation. ODA has sought the additional federal funding, and along the way, the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture has been pretty specific in their request to FDA. You are adding additional responsibilities to the states. We need to see federal funds to help support some of this work because it is such a big change to how the food safety system is in place. For produce producers, fruit and vegetable producers, if they are certified under a GHP GAP program, that's going to move them a long ways mm-hmm. towards compliance. But if they haven't been part of one of those programs, the potential for a real impact and having them look at some significant changes to how they do things is very, very real for them. So I'll pause there, and we're happy to answer any more questions.
Follow up?
Farmer markets, you know, like the farm markets on Saturday and so forth, how do they fit into this cycle?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, it is possible that many of the vendors at farmers markets are exempt either through that exemption for farms with less than $25,000 in annual produce sales or through that exemption for farms with less than $500,000 in annual sales with over 50% of their sales direct to consumer.
Okay.
So if they don't fit into either of those categories, they may be covered. I think we feel strongly that we need to reach out to everyone because their buyers may ask them to meet these requirements even if they're not technically covered, and also because we want to involve them and assist them with protecting food safety as well.
One question I have back on your somewhat shocking cost sheet on how much per farm it may cost for compliance. Do you have any sense if somebody is already GAAP compliant, are some of those costs all lowered because they've already done some of these things?
Chair Clem, Lindsay Ng with the Department of Agriculture. I run our market access and certification programs, so I can answer that question a bit. What I would say the biggest increased cost for GAP certified farms is going to be the water testing. Out of any GAP program that we do, including our Global GAP and Primus GFS programs that are a little bit more rigorous, the FSMA produce rule requires extensive water testing, 5 tests per year per source. Now that could change a bit, but cost estimates of that for larger farms that have quite a variety of different water sources, surface water sources, is very, very extensive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got you there. Do you know in Global GAP, are there still prohibitions of dogs not being able to run around out in the orchards?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, regarding that question, I think that Global GAP has a little bit more flexibility in terms of dogs. I don't think in any GAP standard that I'm aware of are dogs able to roam freely in the field. They're generally discouraged because of the risk of E. coli contamination. And I think that the FSMA rule follows that line of thinking that any domesticated animal, including dogs, unfortunately carries E. coli, and they are not always potty trained.
So, colleagues, just for your entertainment value, the our orchard is Global GAP certified, and this issue, our farm dog got banned from the orchard because of the risk, apparently, that it could hike its leg and pee all the way up the tree and hit the fruit, because that's the basic premise, that you don't want its fecal matter, but the tree's 15 feet off the ground, and I tried talking to the certifier about that, and they said, yeah, it's a stupid rule in an orchard, but sorry, it's the rule. So the dog got banned from the orchard. Just for your...
I hope you have other trees around there he can use.
That are 15 feet or taller.
Yeah, yeah. Some power. Okay. It's a heck of a day here in this committee. Yeah. Anything else for our friends at ODA?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else here to sign up on this that's not signed up? All right, then. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18A. And we're going to open our informational hearing on an overview of invasive species here in Oregon and ask the folks from the Invasive Species Council to come up. So is it Jolene? And do you want... Just, Helmut, I spotted you there, and whoever you've got in your first panel, I've got several other names, but you organize this how you like. And we've got a little video, apparently, at some point.
Yes.
I see it may be an award-winning video.
Yes. Oh. Yes, agreed. So, good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jalene Littlejohn, and I am the coordinator for the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and so I'm really happy to be here today to talk about this important issue for Oregon. So we'll sort of walk through an introduction, answer any questions that you might have, and I'll welcome these wonderful gentlemen here to take it away and talk some more specifics for you. All right, so an invasive species, just the very simple definition by statute is it's, you know, a non-native organism that can be a plant, an animal, a microorganism that's really capable of economic and environmental harm. And it's also able to spread really rapidly. So these are not necessarily animals or plants who, you know, just kind of cause a small amount of a problem. These are animals and plants and microorganisms that are causing real devastating issues for our state specifically, because we're talking about Oregon. So The invasive species issue really crosses all, you know, lines. Invasive species don't, you know, fall on any jurisdictional boundaries. They kind of feel like they can do what they want. And so it really causes an issue for us in our environments, economic issues, as well as in some cases, very real health issues that are caused by invasive species that, you know, aren't always as apparent as some of the other the issues, but they're documented. And so we have, you know, dire consequences that come with invasions of all of these different species. We can have, first and foremost, really high costs for control. If we allow invasive species to take, you know, hold, we can have big losses to industries that are really near and dear to Oregon. We can have, you know, increased pesticide use for those concerns, human health concerns, like I was mentioning, and even extinctions of different species that have been demonstrated. And so they really threaten the way of life that we have here in this sort of, like, it's been talked about before as like this slow fire kind of coming up from behind us that we have to really pay attention to. So I wanted to walk through, yes?
One second. Is it okay to take questions as we go?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, Vice Chair Springer.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your last slide, human health concerns. Explain mm-hmm. how cardiovascular disease and depression made that list.
Yes. So this was taken. We do have some guests here that are a specialist in different areas and have taken from the literature. So would you mind if you were able to answer that question, or do we want?
If it comes up, I'll ask it again.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Awesome. Later. We'll take note. Great. So the stages of invasion, this is a curve that is based on both, you know, time across the axis as well as management costs and the kind of stage of the invasion. So at the front of the curve, you know, in prevention, that's really the key place that we want to be. We want to not allow these particular devastating species to come into Oregon. They're not present yet. That's the most effective place for intervention. That's where we want to be. Once we start to identify that a particular species, a bug, a plant, a pathogen has been identified in the state, there's a small window of time that we have for eradication. After that point of time, the curve you see goes up really, really quickly into that, you know, that increase, that spread quickly phase. And so once you get past the point that you didn't detect it early and you didn't eradicate, then you get into a containment phase where you are, you know, spending a lot of money trying to control that particular species. Once it gets past that point, then you're trying to protect your resources. You're trying to protect your water resources. You're trying to protect these other resources that are important to us. And so it's really hard or potentially unlikely to eradicate at that point. And sometimes unlikely that we'll be able to reverse some of the effects when we get there. And so we really want to, you know, invest at that forefront, and that return on investment is pretty high.
What's that one?
That one is, talk to me.
I'm an entomologist, so sorry.
It's a variety of nightshade. I have it in the notes. I should have placed it up here.
But it's a bat.
Mm. Yes.
It looks nice.
It's invasive. Yes, a lot of times certain invasive plants do look pretty. They flower pretty. I mean, gorse is an example of that. And so that can be, you know, something that is a problem, right?
Yeah.
So invasive species come in all different varieties and all different pathways is how we call and how we've referred to these different mechanisms for invasive species traveling into the state. It's kind of a complex world out there, as we all know, in different situations. And so we're thinking about things like cargo. We're thinking about things like trade. We're thinking about roads. We're thinking about water across, you know, on your shoes when you're hiking. So there's a lot of different ways that invasive species move into the state as well as within the state, and we have to think about those pathways and manage for them. Now, no one entity covers all of these issues, nor does it cover all of these jurisdictions or all of these resources, and so it really demands a coordinated and cooperative effort to tackle the issue of invasive species. This particular picture is an example. This is the team cross-agency with, you know, the ODF and ODA, among others, in the city of Portland working to do treatment for Asian gypsy moth. So there's many, many, many agencies and organizations working on invasive species issues. And just to sort of, you know, talk about the importance of understanding that breadth, we won't be able to get into each and every one of them today. But that is why in 2001, the legislature, you know, put the Oregon Invasive Species Council into action to help be a leader for conducting a comprehensive and coordinated effort around invasive species, because it is such a complex issue. The council is structured such that we have seven permanent positions across these different organizations: ODA, Department of Forestry, DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, State Marine Board, Sea Grant, and Portland State University. And then we also have 10 rotating seats. So they're called appointed, but they're actually sort of elected or term limited. And they can serve two terms of 2 years. And they come, you know, from a variety of different stakeholder organizations, including nonprofit organizations. We currently have someone with the Pacific Northwest College of Art sitting on the council this year, and Customs and Border Protection and others. So the summary of responsibilities set forth here include maintaining a reporting hotline, so anyone can go to the hotline online and report a potential invasive species, and there are experts sitting, you know, on the front lines waiting for to hopefully respond to that quickly and identify and then also educate the public about the invasive species through different means. We are in charge of developing a statewide plan cross-agency for invasive species, and we were able to roll out a new 10-year plan this year. I believe that was available to you, and we also have copies if you'd like to see it that way. And having funding available for eradication efforts in the state, among other specific duties. That's the summary. And so since its creation, I just wanted to note a couple different things that the council is doing that have been effective over time. This is the hotline reporting tool that is available, and there's also a phone number to call, 1-866-INVADER. We've had public outreach campaigns, including Silent Invasion, in partnership with the public OPB, and other campaigns like Squeal on Pigs for Feral Swine, Buy It Where You Burn It, where you don't want to transport larvae of invasive insects in wood as you're traveling in different areas, so things like that. We've also been successful in bringing people together around these meetings and events and thinking about planning in that coordinated effort, because it takes a team. The council also manages an invasive species control account. So this was set up in 2009 as a way to have at least a small amount of emergency funds for eradication efforts. This is how it's been used thus far for a few different species, including invasive tunicates, Japanese beetle, sudden oak death, a new strain, and there's about $89,000 remaining in that really important fund for eradication efforts.
Representative McHugh.
I have a question. The tunicate monitoring. Why are we monitoring tunicates and not eradicating tunicates?
You respond to that, Glenn.
Yeah, for the record, Glenn Dolphin, Oregon State Marine Board, Chair Clem, Representative McEwen. That particular project back in 2015, it occurred in the Charleston Marina in Coos Bay, and the specific species of tunicate was discovered and was seen to be potentially expanding within the facility, and based on the species worldwide, it's a high concern of invader for the state. And so that particular project, because of the potential consequences of the colonial tunicate there, we increased monitoring of the species and started to hand pull the ones we found. And fully, we were ready to start wrapping docks and do an eradication project, and found less of the species than we had anticipated. And the hand pulling became effective to where they weren't reestablishing themselves. And so we did a long-term monitoring, and just this last summer was the last season for the extended monitoring, and the species was hard to find.
Wonderful. Follow up. I also understand there was a colony in the Winchester Bay Triangle.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, yes, you are correct. There is this particular species in the mouth of the Umpqua River in Winchester Bay, and that is an enclosure where there's a shellfish operation. And the tunicate is in that enclosed triangle area. There's no public access to this particular area. And there's a couple culverts that have water transfer from the river to the oyster growing operation. And the monitoring that's occurred has not shown it to be expanding outside of that enclosed area. And so that enclosed area is containing the species within that area.
So is that having any impact on that shellfish industry there? Is it causing any problem for the oyster growers?
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, the oyster growers have indicated no.
Okay, great.
But other situations on the West Coast and the East Coast tell a different story where there's big impacts. So it's quite perplexing at this point as to why it's not showing its negative impacts in Oregon as it has other places in the world.
Well, I guess we'll call that a win. Thank you for the update. I appreciate your work in taking care of that. I know it's been of grave concern in my district, so thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you. And, of course, one of my concerns is the sudden oak death, and I like how you have the E1 slide up there. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith for the records. I'm Helmut Rock with Oregon Department of Agriculture. I will get to this question in my presentation if you have.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I go through the materials here, I've either missed it or missed it in your presentation. How does something become listed, if you will, as an invasive species? The documents talk a lot about why they're bad and how they get there kind of thing, but how we get them in our state. But what is the criteria that is used?
Yeah.
Please. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, again for the records, Helmut Rock with Oregon Department of Agriculture. We look at a lot of these species that come into new places, and we consider them in the first place exotic. Honeybees, for instance, are exotic. They are not native to the Americas. They are not invasive because they don't cause economic damage to our natural or agricultural resources, and that's what the criteria is to define what an invasive exotic species is. As soon as you start to damage either natural resources that could be displacing native flora and fauna or causing economic damage to our agricultural system, that's when we switch from exotic to invasive species.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
Follow up.
I heard the comment earlier about, thank you, Mr. Chair, nightshade. That's an invasive species, and I hate nightshade. We had an incident of it in our house and rushing our son to the emergency room. So it is a big deal. It's a bad thing. But just because it's a bad thing doesn't mean it's an invasive species. So kind of parse that out for me, if you would.
Yeah. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, we have about 50,000 species that are exotic, more or less, that have invaded the United States over the last 500 years or so. And only about 10% of these are considered invasive that are pest. So they are causing either a nuisance to us, brown marmot stickbug, spotted winged drosophila, or tansy ragwort. Some of these invaders do not cause any damage. They are just living in a niche and not affecting us and our natural and agricultural resources.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since in the beginning of your presentation you spoke about not just invasive species being plants but also animals, I'd like to just shift real quick to our predation issues that we have in the state, right? And as far as I'm concerned, we have, you know, these, we'll just talk about simonids and how our sea lion and cormorant population are devastating our hatchery work. We spend over $230,000 of every week on our Oregon hatchery program only to feed these gluttonous animals. And the coordination, of course, between ODF and WA, I know they try, but since these are federally managed, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife is not being helpful, I guess. And so what can we do in the future to really force more predation controls in regards to our salmon populations?
Chair Clem and Representative Smith, I totally hear what you're saying and asking here. I don't know that I am the correct person to ask about that without being able to respond to a particular, dedicated invasive species. I can attempt to follow up on that.
And you may have some of this stuff in your presentation, so maybe we'll just let you go for a while and then we'll see if we cover things that we might otherwise ask anyway.
Thank you, Chair. So I just wanted to give a very quick introduction to the statewide plan as a broad brush about some of the things that we would like to see the state do and some of the things that we are already doing that are successful before we start to get into some specifics. An example. So the statewide plan covers five strategic objective areas, including prevention, early detection and rapid response, control and management, education, and then coordination and leadership as well. And so when we're talking about prevention, we're on that curve. We're at the very beginning. There are invasive species who are not here yet. We don't want them here yet, such as, our zebra and quagga mussels or other species that have not been detected but have been shown to cause, vast economic and environmental harm in other places. And to do this, we're suggesting just for a snapshot of some of the strategies coming out of this that, we really have to think about best management practices, being effective there, having the capacity to implement those, and also for, regional partnerships because, like I said, these species are not abiding by the Oregon, state line. So as we move into early detection, rapid response, those two things go together. We have to be able to detect invasive species early, and that could be one, master gardener bringing one insect in and saying, is this native or is this causing a problem? All the way to seeing, a hillside and detecting that. And so then you need to be able to rapidly respond to that issue, and depending on the particular species and the effective treatment for that, that can vary. But we really need those targeted monitoring efforts and a diverse, array of them, both at the state level and at the professional level, as well as this Oregon Forest Pest Detector Program is more of a professional or even citizen-based detection program that is being implemented by Extension and Oregon State University. And then we need that capacity for response when it happens in a professional manner. So control and management, once a species is here, unfortunately, we do have issues that were presented currently across the state in these different ways, whether it's scotchroom, whether it's gorse, whether it's, different animal species or insect species. We need to be focusing on supporting the local communities in addressing the pathways that are in and out of that current area so that we're preventing that from moving to other parts of the state. And then also thinking about resilience of that community, both in the ecosystem and the community that's affected. So education and outreach, this is where our video comes in for a little bit later, a little bit of a treat for kind of staying with us through the presentation. But we want to focus on collaborating, pooling resources, not reinventing the wheel on this, and being diverse and inclusive in our outreach so that we're reaching across all of the corners of our state. And then within coordination and leadership, this is not only just the council, but also between and kind of being that connection and that glue between all of these different entities and the public who are, you know, in charge of protecting our state from invasive species. We need to have the funding available to be effective in that manner and have really close coordination with, you know, our highest leadership in the state. So there's a lot of different issues presented, and we have, you know, a multitude of experts that are sitting on the council and participate in advisory capacity with the council. I'm not an expert in any one field, but I pride myself on being able to connect you to the answers. And so I'm going to pass it along to Dr. Rog over here to give a little bit more specifics around our agriculture and terrestrial systems.
Yep.
So thank you again, Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the opportunity to present our work here with invasive pests. For the record, I'm Helmut Rock. I'm the director of the Plant Protection and Conservation Programs area with Oregon Department of Agriculture. And the mission of the Plant Protection and Conservation Programs area is to protect Oregon's natural and agricultural resources from invasive pests. My program's dealing with about 95% of all the invasive pest taxa are the Insect Pest Prevention and Management Program, the Noxious Invasive Weed Program, and the Plant Health Program. So what is our approach? As Jolene presented already, our main focus is on prevention. It is easier to keep invasive out than dealing with them when they made it to Oregon and have become established. Our method is the early detection and rapid response that was mentioned by Jolene, or EDRR, to prevent establishment of invasive pests that cause adverse impact on our natural and agricultural resources. And by preventing invasives to become established in Oregon, we reduce unnecessary pesticide applications. We avoid becoming quarantined by our national and international trading partners. And in the end, obviously, this is more economic than dealing with and reacting to an invasion. Let me give you a few examples. Last year it was the Asian gypsy moth. This year is the Japanese beetle. We have detected the largest infestation in the 72-year history of our Oregon Japanese beetle program in Portland, the city of Roses, which, by the way, is one of its preferred hosts. In 2016, we caught a record number of Japanese beetle in the Cedar Mill and Bethany neighborhoods in northwest Portland, which represents about 95% of all Japanese beetle caught since we intercepted Japanese beetle in Oregon in 1988. Now we have the largest eradication happening on about 1,000 acres with about 2,500 properties. It's a five-year project and costs about $2 million. So why do we care? If you don't care so much about roses, JB also attacks hundreds of other hosts, including fruit and vegetable crops that we also like to eat. But Japanese beetle would be devastating to our number one sector, together with the beef industry, obviously, the nursery industry, worth about $1 billion due to potential quarantine restrictions and market losses. Oregon would lose its current status of being free of Japanese beetle that allows our industry to ship freely domestically and also internationally. Other sectors affected are our nut industry and also our wine industry, both worth hundreds of millions of dollars. In eastern Canada, for instance, Japanese beetle is a significant pest of vineyards that requires several pesticide applications during the season. So you've seen the invasion curve, but here it is again with a real-life example. So when we look at the abscissa or the x-axis, and Jolene explained that, we're in the preventive phase. We survey for Japanese beetle with our specific pheromone traps, and we react immediately to the threat of Japanese beetle invading Oregon, as happens almost every year at Portland International Airport. However, if we can no longer early detect Japanese beetle, we will lose the battle to be able to quickly react and eradicate the infestations when they are still relatively small. And that's when the curve goes up. If the infestation areas indicated on the y-axis become too large, it will be too expensive to eradicate the infestation. We have then to switch over to resource protection, if possible, and long-term management. And options in this case with Japanese beetles are very limited. I want to show you some data on our preventive phase. So every year we put out thousands of Japanese beetle traps and thousands of gypsy moth traps and other traps for specific targets that we're looking for. Until the recent economic recession, we averaged about, as you can see, 5,000 Japanese beetle traps every year. So due to budget constraints, the number now is closer to 2,500, about half what we were able to put out just a few years ago. So why is that important to mention? Here is the area of last year's Japanese beetle infestation in northwest Portland. And we had to focus our scarce resources to other high-risk sites, like, as I mentioned, Portland International Airport, where we know that Japanese beetle is coming in on cargo planes from infested states back east. And you see that circle, that's where we found last year the Japanese beetle infestation. We haven't had Japanese beetle traps in that area in Cedar Mill for 5 years due to budget constraints. That is the reason the infestation area is now so large. The eradication efforts are now underway. We started last week. The eradication will likely, if all goes as planned, last at least 5 years and will cost the state almost about $2 million. And we received additional state funding already to start up the project, including $150,000 from the OISE Emergency Fund, as Jolene mentioned. So switching gears, another example of our early detection rapid response approach is the invasive aquatic noxious weed, the flowering rush. This invasive is floating down the Columbia River and threatens our river systems, but also our irrigation systems in the Columbia Basin. How do we know this, that this is going to be an invasive noxious weed? Flowering rush is already established in Montana, as you can see here in this slide, and affecting lakes. And also in Idaho, it's affecting irrigation canals and damaging and threatening here our salmon and costing significant amounts of funds to keep our irrigation canals free. Again, the emphasis is on prevention. We looked at just about 25 of the worst of the 120-plus noxious weeds that are in Oregon. The 25 alone cost $83 million in economic damage every year to Oregon's agriculture and natural resources. If we don't manage them, that includes biological control, for instance, the damage can quickly add up to hundreds or to $1 billion a year. How do we know that? We conducted an economic analysis in 2000 and had it updated in 2015 with the help of renowned economists from OSU and other institutes. Scotch broom and blackberry, as presented before, alone caused damage of up to $80 million a year. The study confirms the importance of our biological control program to reduce the economic damage of noxious weed in Oregon. One of the best examples of our biocontrol program includes the cinnabar moth that we released against the tansy ragwort. Overall, the cost benefit of our biocontrol program is about $1 invested will save our economy $34. For Representative McEwen's benefit, I threw in a slide of our biocontrol efforts with the gorse at the coast. We have currently four agents. One is a weevil, which we've had since the 40s. a spider mite, which worked really well until it is controlled by a predatory mite. And we have a gorse thrips and a gorse shoot moth. Both of them are currently in the lab, and we're investigating it with Oregon State University. We are waiting for federal approval for their field releases. Unfortunately, our biocontrol specialist, who was in this position for almost 30 years and made the biocontrol program to the leading biocontrol program in the nation, retired last summer. Another example to emphasize another aspect of our invasive species work and how it relates to water is the water primrose, or Ludwigia. It's an aquatic noxious weed originally from South America. This aquatic weed is threatening our Willamette River system. Aquatic noxious weeds in general can alter water and soil chemistry and physics, potentially threatening our native fish and flora. The millions of dollars we have already invested in restoring our Willamette watersheds are in jeopardy just by this one aquatic noxious weed. Switching gears again, ODOI also addresses issues with invasive plant pathogens, such as P. ramorum, Phytophthora ramorum, that causes sudden oak death. ODA looks at the nursery side of this disease and how we can mitigate the pathways of plant material in and out of Oregon. Our sister agency and Wyatt William from Oregon Department of Forestry is in the audience here, covers the aspect of P. ramorum and salt in the forest setting that you're all very familiar with in Curry County, Representative Brock Smith in particular, and thank you for your efforts to support that project. Another example of plant pathogens is Xylella. It's a pathogen that causes a variety of diseases, including the Pierce disease in grapes and leaf scorch in pear. And the presence of Xylella in pear in Hood River in 2015 caused that our nursery industry lost access to European markets, where Xylella destroyed thousands of olive trees in Italy. In conclusion, the benefits of being proactive rather than reactive in fighting serious invasive pests are that we are protecting Oregon's biodiversity. Invasive species are the biggest threats to our native species. As shown in particular with the aquatic noxious weeds, being proactive with invasive also protects our watersheds and our water quality. Of course, that also applies to invasive insect pests such as gypsy moth, Japanese beetle, that threaten our important riparian areas. So our work helps reducing unnecessary pesticide applications to control these pests if we don't do it. If we don't keep invasives, like in general or Japanese beetle in specific out of Oregon, our residents or our agriculture industry will use more pesticides to protect their roses, or vegetables, fruit crops, or nursery industry from invasive pests. So overall, this protects our natural and agricultural resources in Oregon and ultimately benefit our overall economy. Thank you. Do we switch? So we switch gear unless there are questions? Are you doing that?
Yep.
There we go. Awesome. Chair Clem, members of the committee, are there other questions? We do have some information about forests for interested members, and also about our aquatic species. So understanding constraints of time, is there a preference for that? I can just give the overall.
I would get the video going because we only have 10 minutes. We're all excited about the
You're all excited about the video. All right. So can I use the mouse or should I just click through? Okay. All right. So we do...
have the number of programs for forestry. So if you're interested for the sudden oak death, there is information about the infestations here and moving forward to the mussel issue. I will follow instruction and show you the Don't Let It Loose video. This was an award-winning video for a high school media contest that was run by the council and by Oregon State Sea Grant. And so it's a very fun way to engage with folks about this. Yeah, it was a fun way to engage with students about the concept of don't let it loose. So things like goldfish or pets or turtles and things that we don't want to become invasive. And hopefully this works for us this way. Very talented.
Okay. Do you remember how old the student was that produced that?
Not exactly.
Yeah, I got to judge that last year.
And thank you.
So
for that.
There were quite a few entries in that program, but I'm pretty sure that was lower elementary, and they're making all kinds of stuff.
I think it. Yeah, upper elementary or. I'm not sure exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions for our group or comments? Representative McKeon.
Chair Clem, just a moment of indulgence, just to make sure that we never miss an opportunity to draw attention to the zebra and quagga mussel threat. I would be remiss if we didn't at least mention the words zebra and quagga and what the potential economic impact of those two on this state is. We don't need to belabor it. We've heard it many times. I just never want to miss an opportunity to for our folks who are listening from afar to make sure that people understand why they pay for those invasive species tags for their boats and what that does to help protect us and our waterways from something that could just be existential and catastrophic. So I just want to put a plug in for the work that you do with trying to keep those out of our waterways, because once they get here, we're in deep trouble. So thank you for an opportunity to pander a bit.
Vice Chair McLean.
I think it was my growing up. I think we cleared 60 to 70 acres of Scotch broom three times during my childhood. Oof. And so it really gave me a real feeling for the importance of dealing with invasive species and the early prevention and studying and trying to look for other ways to control that are more natural. And I feel that your work is so important and that your council is so important, and the work of the ag and the forestry agencies at the state really have some very important work to do in this area, and they're doing a great job, but we can't let down. We have to continue to be vigilant if we want Oregon to have the kind of agriculture and forestry and other types of natural products that we are so well known for. And I just think it's important, and I'm glad you were here today to give us more information and update us on your efforts.
Okay. And are we meeting this Thursday now? Colleagues, I will remind you we're not going to be meeting on Thursday, much to your chagrin, I'm sure, but we will be resuming again next week. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Ag and Natural Resources.
Thank you.
Ag and Natural Resources.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee.